person. Is this the final end of it?
Hoppity Matters. Proudly brought to you by Barfoot and Thompson.
On the show today, the fabulous David Palfreyman is here, real estate coach, auctioneer, and all-round real estate guru. Welcome to Property Matters. Welcome along to another Monday, and after so many short weeks, this week's going to feel like a long one to get through. Hope you all had a fabulous Anzac Day weekend, and if you're driving home and tuning in or listening to us on our podcast or on David's live feed tonight, welcome to Property Matters. Great to have you here, and a big welcome to David Palfreyman. Great to have you here, David.
Mate, thanks for the intro. Real estate guru.
Guru, no pressure.
Actually, I'll tell you what, the first real estate guru that I met was Ivan Johnstone. That would have been back in 2005. Shout out to Ivan Johnstone, Aljoga, Palmerston North. Brilliant. He really, he always put himself out there as the real estate guru.
Ooh, okay. Now, you started your passion for real estate, though, right back as a teenager, so that's why we can call you guru, because it's been a while. Did you do anything before real estate, or was it straight into this?
Yeah, so actually real estate, funny, when you mentioned passion for real estate, I would say I first became really, like, interested in real estate. I remember as a child, you know, my parents, you know, bought property, and literally only two properties in the entire childhood. But I remember being curious about that process. But it was not until I started reading quite a few books, I guess, on setting yourself up financially that I noticed a very common theme was that they intended to invest in real estate. So that was kind of the first curiosity about real estate. And the next one came about actually because I was working as a call center operator. So I was the one doing those annoying telemarketing calls. And one of our core kind of areas of business was to call for real estate agents, appointment setters, effectively finding people that, you know, might be thinking about making a move and teeing up an appointment for them. And I had a lot of fun with that, which kind of keyed me onto the idea that I could actually be quite good at real estate, and that could be a good way to build, you know, both financial cash flow and wealth over time. So that's
brilliant.
That's what got me in. But yeah, they were pretty young. I would say 16. Yeah. 16 I was doing that. 17 I was like thinking about what am I going to do when I get old? Older.
<That's>
and cool. I was thinking, well, I don't want to work my whole life, so I'd rather set myself up, and real estate seemed like a good way to go.
But those call centres are great life experience. I started off selling advertising in the Yellow Pages.
Oh,
yeah, that was one of my first call centre jobs.
Good. Do the Yellow Pages still exist?
I don't know, but most people, you know, started using the doorstops and things.
Makes us feel old.
And to hold computer monitors up. You know, weren't they fantastic for that?
I feel like I really wish that I had some. The other day I had to call an emergency online auction when all the ferries got cancelled.
Oh, right.
And so I'm propping up my laptop, and I tell you what, a nice phone book would have done
the trick.
Would have been helpful. Yeah.
So, okay, you leave teenagehood and into the real world. Talk us through your real estate journey.
Well, I think it's interesting. As a young adult, a late teenager, thinking about life, I thought I needed to think, you know, what was the thing that I was going to do for the rest of my life. And I think I was lucky that I chose to get into real estate, but I would certainly say to anybody else who's in that situation or got, you know, young people that they're helping to guide, is a piece of advice that I received much later in life from a business coach who said, you should really think about your life in 2-year stints, because 2 years is enough to give something a real good crack, and then you know if you want to renew it. And I would say after the first 2 years in real estate, I definitely knew I wanted to renew it. But yeah, it was good. I guess getting into real estate for me was, I was just very, very lucky that I started with a very good business, a very high-performing business. In fact, I believe it was the number one LJ Hooker office in the world at that time, out of like 750 offices.
Wow.
So I was part of a very high-performing culture, and it came from some great people. Keith Merritt, the owner of the business, he's a huge property developer, and Steve Allen, who effectively, you know, managed the sales team, and he's such a good man and a great leader and a great coach as well. I wouldn't be here if it hadn't been for those people.
That's cool. So you started in sales. Where did you head to next?
Next, actually, and that's Barfoot and Thompson was, and obviously is such an amazing real estate business. They had a my old real estate coach, Teresa Weiss, who is a very dear friend now, but she was a real estate trainer and coach with LJ Hooker, and then she went to Barford and Thompson and she was heading up their training department, and she kind of went into extended maternity leave and was looking for someone. And we knew each other reasonably well, and she thought I would be brilliant as a trainer and I needed to do something new.
Yep.
And it's interesting, like that real estate, I think about that journey piece, you know, real estate I got into it as a salesperson, and I've often over the years had these moments where I've thought maybe I need to do something different. Like, I want to reach my potential. I've got an itch to scratch, but I've been lucky to just be able to do different things in the same industry vertical, if you like. But that training piece was what brought me to Auckland to work with Barford and Thompson as a corporate trainer.
And now a real mix of things. You're mentoring, you're coaching, you're running leadership, you're guest speakers at many events, but also running auctions.
Mm.
Do you like that variety and mix?
Yeah, I'm the sort of person that enjoys variety. I think if I didn't have the variety, I would lose some of my excitement and enthusiasm for what I was doing. And it's interesting, like, I was chatting to actually a new friend on the ferry, and she, you know, made a real point of saying thank you to the people who are running the boats as we got off, and I noticed it and noted it, and she said, yeah, well, you know, it's so important to have people doing these sort of things and we should see them and be grateful. And I thought, well, that's very true. I actually thought, you know, that would be a really fun job to do for like a day a week, but I take my hat off to people who can do it for, you know, those sort of periods. And I think for me, I'm very lucky that I get to do different things that all leverage my experience and expertise, but there's a lot of variety there which suits me. And so I enjoy it. I'd say I think I have found quite a good mix. I definitely wouldn't say that I've got it like perfect. I'm always looking for ways to optimize, but I think the training and coaching side and the auctions, there's a lot of synergy there, because as a practitioner, you know, on the auction floor, I'm engaging with the real pointy end of the market, if you like, where buyers and sellers are coming together, and I get to have those conversations. So I'm effectively, especially in this market, I'm often negotiating. So I'm actually going between those two parties. And for me, you know, the auction is just a brief moment in time, but it's kind of, in some ways, it is a very important moment in time, but it's off the back of, you know, weeks in the market. So I'm talking to the salespeople during the campaign. I'm often meeting and talking strategically with the sellers. And so there's quite a lot that goes into it before you get there. But all of that, everything I observe and learn in that space, I can then actually help salespeople to do better business in my training and coaching. And similarly, as I help those salespeople do better work, they generally do more work, and then it comes back to me in auction revenue. So it's a very virtuous cycle, and it works well.
I was going to ask if you miss the selling side of real estate, but I guess if you're coaching in that way, you're kind of getting that taster.
I'm getting my favourite part.
You're getting the fuel part of it anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I think that is so true. I definitely, after having left real estate as a salesperson and moved into the training side, I think I learned so much as a trainer. And that may sound bizarre to people who have never trained, but when you're training, you really learn something well. And in fact, there's a guy, shout out to Gary Singh, if you're watching, mate, or listening. But Gary's an incredible performer, and he runs a team in South Auckland. And he won an award at Ray White, effectively a growth award, and he was already an incredibly busy salesperson, yet during the downturn, he basically doubled his revenue, which is quite remarkable. And when I asked him about it, the thing that he put it down to, he said two things. And the first is going to sound like a stage play, but he said, I understand how to run auction campaigns well. And this was the piece that I was like, oh my gosh, it's incredible. He was asked by the business owner to run a fortnightly coaching and mentoring session for what they call the new start team in that business. And he said that was the thing. It was because he was training these people and coaching them, he said it just reminded him of all the things that he could or should be doing, and then he just implemented them and got it done.
Brilliant.
So I think, yeah, it's really interesting how that works, though.
When you look back over your career, are there certain moments that you would sort of pinpoint on the map as either turning points or real highlights?
Oh, that's such a good question. Yeah, I remember, and I think it's kind of, in a way, what led me here to what I do today. I was really lucky. Once again, Steve Allen, you know, great man and my leader in the business when I was selling, I think he saw something in me of a nature of not just being a salesperson. I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but also in that, you know, that I had other itches to scratch, to put it in that way. And he, because I'd been, I'd say both quite fortunate and quite hardworking to have success that I did very early on, he felt it was worthwhile putting forward to speak at a national sales summit, and I leaped at it. And I got to speak and present, and it went really, really well. And it was absolutely terrifying. You know, like that was so far out of the comfort zone for me. But there was the part of me that wanted to do it. And I think quite often success at the beginning feels like that. You know, you kind of know you want to do this thing, but it terrifies you, but you don't let that stop you from doing it. You work hard, you prepare, you then face that fear. And I mean, it doesn't always go your way, but I think sometimes there's these little things in the universe, the beginner's luck. And I did really well, and it was amazing. And I kind of realized the power of, I must have had, like, I got to have, I spoke for, I think, 30 minutes, but I got to have a 30-minute conversation with several hundred people. Mm. And that's such a powerful thing that I really enjoyed. And so, but weirdly enough, I had that kind of moment, and then I didn't do anything with it really for years. But when Teresa called me out, and actually it wasn't Teresa, Teresa suggested me, it was a lady, Mary Sharp, a very brilliant lady too. She called me and asked if I'd ever thought about it, and I was immediately taken back to that moment. Immediately taken back to that moment, and I thought, that's what I'm meant to do. That's the next thing. That's what I want.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was the next step on the journey.
Brilliant. You always have this super charismatic energy about you. What do you think, sort of, how do you get that passion out every single day?
Well, part of it is very much just a natural makeup, and the other part I think is quite intentional about what I do to help my energy. So, like, I am genuinely curious, and I really like people. You know, the word philanthropy is an interesting one, because most people think philanthropy means you give lots of money to causes, and I think that's what it's become. But the word in Greek means love of people, and I genuinely like people, and I like a very wide range of people too. I find them interesting, and I enjoy it, you know. So for me, I think that was helpful as a real estate salesperson, but it's helpful with my energy, because I think people tend to find that people who like them or are curious about them and interested in them, I think we tend to find those people are attractive in that kind of charismatic way. Yeah. So for me, it's really lucky. I don't have to turn anything on per se. I'm just genuinely interested in talking with people.
It really comes across.
Thank you. Yeah.
What do you think has been some of your biggest challenges that you've had to overcome in your career?
I think it would be good to talk about it. I will just say the other thing, though, just very quickly on the energy piece, because that's the other half of it. So half is a natural thing, but I've had plenty of times, and we can even, this threads through into the challenge thing, I've had plenty of times where I haven't necessarily been firing on all cylinders. And as I have, I guess, just through experience, seen what works for me and what doesn't, it's going to sound so basic, and people listening are going to say, yeah, duh. But it really does come down to, you know, do you drink enough water? Mm. Do you get enough sleep? Mm. Is the sleep quality good? Have you got you're going to have all your basic needs met.
Yeah.
But then you can go a little bit further than that, and actually, you know, in terms of the food that you put in your body, have you got your macronutrients balanced well? For me, that means roughly 30-40 in terms of carbs, fat, and protein. And when you get the balance right and you're eating largely whole foods and good quality foods, then you're putting good stuff in your body, you can perform well. And then the final piece of that puzzle, which really becomes important to eat well, is the exercising. And, you know, for many years I was active, but I was never deliberately exercising, like not going to the gym or anything. I always thought the gym was a bit of wank, to be honest. You know, like, but now I'm that guy.
Yeah.
You know, and for no other reason than I really feel the difference. And for me, it's great for the headspace. It's so good for the energy. And I feel like, especially as I've started to get close to 40, now I am no longer able to just rely rely on my natural metabolism and active lifestyle to keep me in great shape. I actually have to work at that. Mm. But it's great for the headspace too, because you're no longer going backwards, you're going forwards. So those things help me to then have great energy when I'm present with people.
So putting all that together, how's that? It's obviously helped you rise over some challenges in your career.
So the challenges thing is interesting. Like, I think probably the hardest times in my life have been where, you know, I just wasn't quite doing the right thing, either with my life in general or with what I was pursuing. Like, there's no point kind of bashing your head against a brick wall, but sometimes it doesn't feel like you're bashing your head against a brick wall. It just lost a bit of enthusiasm. And for a lot of reasons, when I was selling real estate in Palmerston North, towards the end of that sales career, I just lost the love of it.
Right.
And I yet persisted because I was doing well financially out of it. And with real estate, you build a big client base. Mm. And so it's hard to just, I guess, let that go. But actually, if I was going to go back in time, perhaps, you know, a couple of years too long doing that, I don't know. But everything is there for a reason, you know. But I think, you know, some better work on, as I say, some of those key things would possibly have helped as well. What are the challenges? But I guess just to close the circle on that, like making the tweak and I guess following that actual passion to actually be a speaker and a presenter and a trainer and kind of pass on the knowledge rather than just using the knowledge was a step straight into passion for me, which helps. So, other challenges. I think a big one that I've had to get good at, and my wife will laugh at me when she hears me say get good at this, but I do think I'm pretty good at it now, but it's not come naturally, is organisational ability.
Right.
Because I think about what I do, and it's only because I'm well organised that I'm able to be able to do what I do. Mm. Whereas if you were to rewind the clock and go back, I don't know, 10 years ago, and you know, I was a high-functioning, disorganized person, whereas now I deliberately focus on it. And for anyone who might resonate with what I'm talking about, read the book Getting Things Done, GTD. It's a guy, David Allen, and he lays out a framework about how to effectively deal with stuff, because we always have stuff coming at us. And certainly in my line of work, and I'm sure in most people's line of work in this day and age, we deal with so many inputs and so many things that require us to figure out what something is. Do we need to keep it? Do we need to action it? And everything that cascades from that point. But yeah, that book was phenomenally helpful to me, and becoming more organized solved a lot of challenges.
And you're not the first person to mention that book on the show.
Really? Yeah. There you go. Shout out to David Allen. Yeah. Good man. Good
Absolutely. Man. Yeah. All right, let's look at the current market today. What's your sort of feeling about what you're seeing, especially in the auction room? What is this current state of market in your eyes?
Yeah, well, I think it's a good thing, and if that's a question that you're tuning in for, it's important to understand what's your perspective. In other words, are you looking at this because you own property and you're trying to figure out a next move? Is it because you're curious on someone else's behalf? Because the market is different depending on the property and its location, and therefore its price point. So there's a lot of, you should be very careful about taking general advice and making it very specific to your situation. So I'd say it's worthwhile to reach out to someone who does know what they're talking about to get some advice. But in general terms, if we now go right back out, I interviewed just recently a guy, Nick Goodall. Actually, he's got a property podcast himself, and he's the head of research for CoreLogic. But I asked Nick about the market in general terms, and this is a data guy, right? He's the head of research for CoreLogic. They look at the number of transactions that have taken place, and I think this is a fascinating metric. 85,000 transactions for the whole of New Zealand in the last 12 months. I believe that was to March. And then he makes a prediction. He says, well, I think that over the next 12 months, we'll probably see 92,000 transactions. Right. And I'm like, okay, so we see an uplift in the volume of transactions. But he goes on to say, like, that effectively we still have a bit of an oversupply scenario, and it's actually a great time to be buying. And I ask him, I say, okay, well, hang on a second. If it's a great time to be buying, why are so many people selling?
Mm.
And there's a little moment there, and I think, you know, this is a question that's in my mind, and it's the question someone, well, I think, should be asking. And he goes, yeah, David, you have to understand that it's not that heaps of people are rushing to the market to sell. It's just that a normal amount of people are coming to the market to sell, but the rate of absorption, the actual number of transactions, is lower. and I asked them, well, what is the normal level? Well, and it's not really any such thing as normal, but the average is 95,000. So this is the thing that gets us to there is currently, and I say this based purely on the frame of reference of how many transactions are happening, there is an oversupply in general in the market. So if you look into absorption rates, you can work out, you know, how many months of inventory are available based, in other words, how many, for example, houses are for sale in a particular marketplace versus how many transactions are happening on a monthly basis. And here's a number for anyone who wants to go and work this out, and then you'll know what sort of market you're in. Anywhere less than 4 months of available inventory, less than 4 months available stock, is a seller's market. Anything more than 6 months is a buyer's market. And somewhere in between the 4 to 6 months range is a more balanced market.
Right.
And almost every marketplace that I'm operating in at the moment, it is a buyer's market.
Right.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that buyers have all the power, but it does mean that if you are a buyer and you know what you want, you can probably buy it.
Mm.
Whereas it's, you know, the marketplace of a red hot market, it's heartbreak for some buyers who fall in love, do everything they can to own the property and still miss out. So I think it's a good market to be buying and selling in. And as long as you're well looked after as a seller and you're intelligent about your approach, you can still sell very, very well. Liquidity is in the market.
So if we think of those salespeople, and you would have met many, many, many over your years in this industry, what do you reckon makes, I guess, what makes a good salesperson, and what advice would you give someone starting out in today's buyer's market as a salesperson?
Well, funny enough, I think, and maybe it's just because I was like this, but I think it helps to like people, because so much of the work is work with people. In fact, people get into real estate sometimes because they like houses, but the houses are almost the byproduct of people making decisions. So, I mean, I'm sure it's helpful if you've got some technical expertise, but it's not needed.
Mm.
But, and sure, you know, it'd be helpful if you maybe had some marketing or sales experience, but it's not needed. But what you do have to have is an ability to communicate well with people, and you've got to have a pretty high work ethic. I look at the successful salespeople, and when I say success, real estate's quite good as a self-employed role, effectively, that you can make it optimize for what is important to you. But if you measure success on pure productivity of the number of sales that are being made or the money that's being made, generally those salespeople are working pretty hard. Back to the question, what makes a good salesperson? I think they need to have a good work ethic. They need to get on well with people. The ability to tell the truth well is so key. I think sometimes salespeople either try and fudge the truth or avoid it. There's a real estate trainer, Tom Panos, who says real estate is a series of difficult conversations. And particularly in a tougher market, you really have to engage pretty ruthlessly with reality. But I'd say that ability to understand, you know, how to help people get to where they need to get, and be able to help them understand the reality that they're working in, is real key. And if you enjoy working with people, then you won't mind the work that you have to do.
And how much should these salespeople be worried or navigating the sort of the market flowing, and like you talked about, the buyers, the sellers market, etc.? Should this be something that they're really focused on, or just get down to their core business?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately you've got to be quite in tune with what the market's doing so you can be a good advisor. Like, I really think that some salespeople should be more educated on what's happening in their marketplaces, and others actually know incredibly well what's going on, but perhaps need to, or perhaps would benefit from sharing it more widely.
Mm-hmm.
But the ability of those salespeople to understand what's happening is it's good if they're putting it into practice, but it doesn't matter whether the market is, you know, a red hot seller's market or a really, you know, from a selling salesperson's perspective, a challenging buyer's market. Actually, Gary Singer is a great example of this. You can excel in any market as long as you understand that you have to change tack. It's like different sailing downwind than it is sailing upwind, and you do have to understand how to work with the environment that you're in. And I'd say that, you know, talk about challenges, it's a good one to go back to. Like, I started in a red hot seller's market. The most important piece of the work that I was doing at that time, and this is going to sound bizarre, and for people who think real estate agents are overpaid and, you know, just, you know, getting the put this way, you didn't have to sell the property.
Right.
The property would sell itself. Mm. What you had to do was you had to be great at being able to showcase your ability. So I was, at that point, I became very good at winning the listing, and I was good at selling, and I was absolutely fastidious in my follow-up, and I did everything that I should be doing. But when the market turned, it was really challenging because I didn't understand how important it was at that time to help the sellers understand the market. So what happened is, I remember I was winning listings, which was good, but I wasn't converting them anymore. And I think, you know, I was possibly, maybe I was even underperforming the rate of conversion. And what I mean by that is, like, if you've got 500 properties in the market and only 100 of those properties are selling every month, like, what do you need to do to make sure that it's, you know, that the property you're representing is one of those ones that's transacting? Mm. And there's actually only so much you can do in terms of the marketing side and in terms of the salesmanship with buyers. The other part of this, and I reckon, I think it was Mark McLeod who said there are four sales that a salesperson has to make in a campaign. The first sale is you've got to get in front of the client. That's the work that we were doing in the call centres, setting an appointment.
Absolutely.
The second sale is you've got to actually have work with them to a point where they trust you, they know that you can do the work, and they choose to appoint you as their agent. So that's the second sale that you have to do. You've got to secure the agency. But most salespeople, and I would have been included in this, think the third sale is you have to sell the property to a buyer. But the problem is if you try and sell the property to a buyer and you haven't yet sold the market to the vendor, then their owner might miss a really good offer and not realize it. And in fact, I see agents who, this is true, it's not that they have to somehow sell the market to the vendor. Sometimes it's the agents don't know the market yet because it's always changing. And so I think, and that's one of the things I really enjoy as an auctioneer, is that effectively by committing to an auction campaign, the seller does two things. They say to the marketplace, we're seriously selling, and they're almost transparent in saying, we actually don't know what we should accept as a price for our property. Yeah. We want as much as we can get, but we do want to sell. And so as an owner, you signal to the market sincerity of wanting to meet the market, but you also buy a bit of time. And this is the part where you, a quality agent will be constantly benchmarking through that those next few weeks, so that anyone who's not going to pursue this property becomes information. Anyone who's possibly interested, a quality salesperson is doing everything they can to get that buyer there ready to go on auction day. But or if they need conditions, even getting an offer in writing to present so the seller knows what the conditional market looks like. But the ability then is for the owners to have a bit of confidence as to what is a good price and what's not a good price. And there's plenty of properties which I've passed in, and thank goodness we passed in because they sold for more post-auction. Yeah. And there's plenty of properties that have been, you know, passed in and they should have sold, and they're now wishing that price was still there. I think it's okay for disappointment on auction day, as long as you got good information so you can make a quality decision. Because it really doesn't matter if you sold it 3 weeks or 6 weeks in most cases. But I tell you what, it does matter in most cases if you're still on the market 6 months later. So that's what I see it helping with in the current environment.
Are auctions still sort of, in your eyes, is it a preferred way to sell?
Put it this way, if anyone who's a mate of mine hears this question, they know what I'm going to say. But I would say I'm agnostic. I think, you know, I just had a catch up with a friend of mine who's going to sell. I think, you know, if you've different salespeople do tend to prefer different methods. However, knowing what I know and having been across a great scale of transactions now, I would absolutely use auction, almost more important in the current environment than, and most people think auction is the right method for a hot market. And I mean, it's very visible why that is the case. But in a tougher market, or just simply one that more where there's more stock and it tends to favour the buyer a little bit, I think it's even more important, because auction takes a little bit of power away from the buyer, in the sense that they can't make a love letter. They can't write you a love letter without substance. In other words, they can't put an offer in on a property saying subject to the sale of our property, which they've not even had appraised, let alone put on the market yet, and they think might be worth $2 million when in fact it's only 1.5. And there's other cases where sellers have accepted an offer like that with good numbers written on it, but the property doesn't even go to the market because the person so I think dealing with cash is always a preference. But the other thing that happens, and particularly this is interesting in this marketplace, is that where buyers are given that confidence of transparency, in some cases they'll extend. And I mean, let's be transparent. This is probably like maybe 1 out of 20 auctions at the moment. But still, 1 out of 20, that's a 5% chance, is like winning the lottery. Like, it just goes and keeps going. And everyone in that room, even the buyers in some cases, know that they are paying too much almost, you know what I mean? It's hard for them to say that it's too much because there's a guy $500 behind. Yeah. But at the same token, that's a sale that's spiked on the upward trend. And so I think you give yourself the chance of that, and you give yourself good information. And in many cases, and I would say this is, you know, more likely than not, I reckon at the moment, clearance rates are probably fluctuating between the 30 to 40% under the hammer, which means more often than not, it's not actually sold on the day. But I would say of the balance of that, maybe, 60%, there or 70% that is now available post-auction. For the ones who have understood the market, they're then pricing appropriately and are generally transacting pretty promptly afterwards. And so they are one of those sales that actually transacts, as opposed to the ones that sit there. And I think you don't, as an owner, you don't have to sell your property. Mm-hmm. But if you do intend to sell it, you want to work out as quickly as possible and as accurately as possible what an appropriate level to do that is, and give yourself the benefit of upside.
Mm. In this world of, you know, AI technology and social media and everything sort of thrown at us in that technical space these days, if we think back to those call centre days, is there still room for the old school methods? Are we still able to knock on a door and try and, you know, coax some business, do those cold calls? Do those old school ways still work?
100%.
Great.
Yeah. Well, like, get the call centre one.
Yeah.
Now, there are now, and you could, for people at home listening, watching, check out Air AI, AIR AI, and there are other providers, and there are some that are niche specifically to real estate, but these are effectively AI powered voice bots that are really realistic and have a conversation. You know, that outbound work on the phone, I think it's either here or almost here that those roles will be replaced by AI. What is much harder to replace is once the connection's been made and you've actually been to meet those people and view the home and, you know, talk strategically, now you're their advisor. That's very hard to replace, because you're there. There's everything about the dynamic that you create. And so I think the follow-up, sure, you can have an AI catch, if you like, and prevent some leakage. But to really progress people intelligently, I think we're still better at this point.
Yeah.
How much longer for? You know, I hope it's for quite a while, but you never know. And maybe I shouldn't be hoping it's, because who knows? But I would say door knocking, and this is an interesting one. I love some people to put on the comments of your podcast, or indeed on the chat here. Like, when was the last time you had an agent knock at your door? I mean, I haven't had anyone on Waiheke. I haven't had anyone in the city. Where was I before that? In this, Cardwell Street. Never had anyone there. I mean, maybe I'm not home enough. But I just think, like, you want to communicate on the least crowded channel.
Yeah.
And particularly if you're a salesperson, I think it's a sensible strategy to become a specialist in an area. It makes it much easier to speak with authority. It's much easier to be a big fish in a small pond. And the easiest way, the great thing and the unusual thing in some respects about real estate, is that the inventory is all owned by people. In other words, the houses all are owned by people. And all those people, it's it's a physical locality, and either it's a rental property, in which case you can track the owners down a different way, or they live there, and so it's quite easy to build up a contact base of people that are specific to the area that you want to specialise in. So I would say if I went to an area where I knew no one, I would probably do a mixture of content that demonstrated my expertise in that area, so people knew that I knew what I was talking about, and I'd get out and go and meet the people that live there.
Brilliant. Now, you do a lot of coaching and mentoring. Talk us through the sort of different styles of coaching that you do.
Well, it's interesting. I actually don't do as much coaching now as I used to. So, effectively, the auction work has replaced a lot of the coaching stuff. But I use the word coach rather than trainer in a lot of my marketing, if you like, because I do think the difference between training and coaching, it can be subtle, but it's quite important. In a coaching session, even if it's a coaching session one to many, I want to understand the environment those people are operating in. I want to have a dialogue rather than just a stand and deliver. Because if I can understand the challenges they've got and I can put some good questions to them, some thought provokers, and maybe tell a parable or two, or, you know, get that thing, that is much more effective than me, you know, grabbing a piece of content and delivering it 100 times, which I think is more the traditional training kind of way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what I think. I enjoy... most of my presentations, I'll have some set plays because people want to see the slide. They want a couple of quick wins. They want some dialogue. But I always find that people like it when they've come with a problem or they had an epiphany because of you know, a thought-provoking question that I left them with.
Love it. All right, we're down to the last 4 minutes. That's quick fire time.
All right, mate.
Are you ready?
Go for it.
Now, you've recently started a podcast, Home Run. What's the goal of this podcast? Taking me on.
Yeah, home run. No. Mate, well, it's good to collaborate. We might have to get you across the line. Yeah, so Home Run, it's a collaboration with a guy, Harp Singh. He's a mate of mine, runs Blank Canvas Productions, which is probably the best, well, I don't want to offend anyone, but they do incredible work in real estate, photography and videography.
Yep.
And Harp's has got a great eye, but he's also so fascinated by real estate. In fact, we met because we're working together on the pilot for a reality TV show about real estate agents. And we thought it'd be a brilliant idea to just explore a niche which didn't seem to be being explored that well, where we look at kind of the what the industry knows, but that consumers in general don't. So it is consumer facing, and it's the whole gamut about real estate, everything from the financing side, the deal making side, the technical and legal side, right the way through to the physical side, landscaping, architecture, renovations, construction, consenting, planning, the whole gamut. So we're having some fun with it.
Brilliant. How much is social media playing in your
very
your
quick
world?
Plug out to it. Home run. podcast.co.nz.
Brilliant. Well, there's your social media place too. So social media is a big part of your world.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like I think social media, I just think the online world tends to mirror the real world and the real world tends to mirror the online world. So where I can, especially say, for example, content like this, it just makes sense for it to go out on social media at the same time.
Absolutely. Top tip for buying or selling today?
I think as a buyer, you want to look at properties that you know catch your interest and work out what you think they're worth and then actually see where they actually sell. And then you can trust your own judgment on values rather than needing to rely on someone else. I think much the same as a seller, you know, going to auction, it's not the only way, but it's definitely a very powerful way. But you should look at your property through the eyes of a buyer. So look at the watchlist report, see what it's competing against. Historical sales are historical. You know, getting an agent to do an appraisal is a bit like getting someone to tell you what tomorrow's price is today based on yesterday's information. So those are little pieces of advice. Get good people that you can trust around you that will advise you on the legal and technical.
Brilliant. If you could go back in time and sit your 16 or 17 year old David self down, what advice would you give him knowing what you know now?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say keep going hard, mate. but I would say, you know, don't stress so much because I was really stressed about what am I going to do with the rest of my life. And actually, I'm glad I chose to work in real estate. But I think I would have just taken a little bit of the pressure off and said, mate, just what are you going to do for the next 2 years? What would you like to try? And you can always renew it after that. And I think I would guide anyone in the same way. You know, the people that employ you, like what's their, inverted commas, agenda? You know, like I think Steve, he really wanted to see me be successful. And so he was so invested behind me and supporting me with my success that he gave me the care and the attention and the advice and supported me through that growth. I think that was just invaluable, and that's what you should look for in real estate or in anything that you're going to do. Who are you working with and for?
What a perfect way to end the show. Thank you, David, for sharing your wisdom and your passion tonight. How can people get in touch with you and find you and follow you?
Yeah, it's an unusual name, David Palfreyman. You can just find me at thepalf.com if you need to. I think I've got a link tree there that'll point you in the right direction. But yeah, track me down, David Palfreyman. I don't mind chatting. I always sort of say I had lots of people give me a lot of helpful advice in the beginning, and I've always got time for a couple of minutes if you want to chat.
Amazing. Thanks, David. We'll catch up with you again soon. Take care.
Thanks, Stephen.
Thanks for tuning in tonight. If you're driving home, drive safe. We'll catch you next week on Property Matters. Remember, you can download our podcast from all your favourite podcast sites. Have a great week. Catch you next week.